Airlines Confidential with Ben Baldanza and Scott McCartney is made possible with support from Pratt & Whitney, committed to working smarter, cleaner, and greener today for a more sustainable tomorrow. Learn more at PrattWhitney.com. DoHop, revolutionizing travel connectivity. Learn how to unlock unlimited connections simply at DoHop.com. And Cirium, the world's most trusted source of aviation analytics. Visit Cirium.com. We also welcome your business's support. Info at airlinesconfidential.com.
Welcome to Airlines Confidential. I'm Ben Baldanza, ready to play ball this week. It's already time for baseball season, and that means airlines are well into the spring break travel rush and preparing for the summer travel surge. Spring break travel seems to be going well, don't you think, Scott McCartney?
I do, Ben. Happy baseball season to you. Airlines for America said this past week that spring break, which it considers to be the months of March and April, is a home run for airlines this year, with an average passenger load of 2.7 million people per day. That's a record. We'll talk to John Heimlich, the chief economist for the airline group, about the airline economy and maybe a little baseball too. Speaking of baseball, Ben, airlines are playing hardball with Boeing, and we're finally starting to see some major movement on the bases. The Wall Street Journal reported last week that a group of airline CEOs were requesting a meeting with Boeing directors without CEO David Calhoun. That was a major vote of no confidence. And a few days later, whether related or not, Boeing announced that CEO David Calhoun would leave at the end of the year, and a search has begun for a new CEO. In addition, Stan Deal, who is the CEO of Boeing Commercial Airplanes Division, is retiring immediately. He's being replaced by Stephanie Pope, the company's newly installed chief operating officer. And Boeing Chairman Larry Kellner, who many listeners will remember as the former CEO of Continental Airlines, will not stand for re-election. He'll be replaced by Stephen Mollenkopf, a Boeing director who is the former chief executive of Qualcomm, a semiconductor company. It's the major overhaul of the Boeing team that people have been expecting, Ben. To me, Boeing needs to find a new CEO fast, not waiting 9 months until the end of the year. So who is the best player out there? Would you try and go get Mary Barra from General Motors or Jim Farley from Ford? Both have experience running big manufacturing companies, dealing with international markets, focusing on high-profile public safety issues. Would you get someone who ran the Pentagon, maybe? Would you try to entice Ed Bastian from Delta or Scott Kirby from United? In terms of internal candidates, Stephanie Pope would seem to be the only option, and she only became COO in January. But she's been at Boeing almost 30 years. It seems to me Larry Kellner is probably stepping aside to just give a clean slate, right? I don't think Larry would be a candidate, but he could certainly do the job if he was willing.
Boeing Chief Financial Officer Brian West told an investment conference that Boeing will report a massive first quarter loss, a hit of at least $4 billion. No surprise there. Boeing is delivering fewer airplanes. It will be compensating airlines hundreds of millions of dollars for the three-week grounding of the MAX 9 and its spending to get its manufacturing fixed. Boeing is slowing production rates for the 737 it had originally planned on speeding it up this year. And West said Boeing was planning to buy Spirit Aerospace for cash and debt without issuing new equity that would dilute existing shareholders. Boeing had almost $16 billion in cash and short-term investments at the end of the year, but big losses will hit that hard.
To me, the biggest loss is that Boeing will come out of this much weaker financially and less able to invest in a new narrow-body airplane, which is what it badly needs. To use the baseball analogy, Boeing is going into the next series with a lot of significant injuries. And by the way, Ben, buying Spirit AeroSystems, which Boeing spun off years ago, isn't as simple as one might think. Spirit makes crucial structures for Airbus, it could be bad for the industry if Spirit suddenly drops Airbus as a customer and Airbus deliveries get slowed up by Boeing's move. Airline CEOs would be doubly ticked off at that. Some very interesting notes I wanted to run through, Ben. First, the FAA said it was relocating control of Newark, New Jersey airspace from the New York TRACON to the Philadelphia TRACON. New York has a huge staffing shortage, as we've talked about before. Philadelphia doesn't. We've mentioned this plan. The FAA saw this as a significant help in its air traffic control staffing problem, but Senator Charles Schumer of New York had blocked it. Finally, the FAA is moving forward and has an agreement with the Air Traffic Controllers Union to make the move by the end of June. Way to go, FAA Administrator Mike Whitaker. Note number two, JetBlue announced it was cutting routes because of aircraft grounded for Pratt & Whitney engine repairs and to improve profitability by shedding unprofitable flights. Los Angeles International takes a bunch of the cuts, with daily departures dropping there to 24 from 34, and service from Los Angeles to San Francisco, Seattle, Miami, Las Vegas, Reno, and Puerto Vallarta all being suspended. JetBlue is also ending service to Bogota, Quito, Lima, and Kansas City in June. A few routes from Fort Lauderdale will be cut too. Note number three, Gil West, the former chief operating officer of Delta, who was a leader of a lot of the operational turnaround at that airline, was named CEO of Hertz, the rental car company. Gil's a great guy and a terrific operator, and I always enjoyed interviewing him because I learned a lot about running an airline every time. He left Delta a few years ago, but I thought it was a really good move for Hertz to get a smart problem solver on board. Note number four, Alaska Airlines started a subscription service called Alaska Access. For $5 a month, you get access to exclusive deals, discounted Wi-Fi, and a tip-off the night before fare sales. Sounds a lot like your Spirit Airlines $9 fare club, Ben. I guess that's now called the Spirit Savers Club. That's now $70 a year and offers exclusive fares and discounts on baggage fees and seat fees. And note number five, a few days ago, Asiana Airlines retired its last 747 passenger jet, leaving only four airlines in the world flying passengers on the iconic Queen of the Skies. The four are Air China, Korean Air, Lufthansa, and Mahan Air, an Iranian carrier. Hard to believe that 747 service is in the ninth inning, Ben.
Not when you count the engines, Scott. Two is better than four for fuel burn. Alaska has been experimenting with pricing issues. Remember their fly all you can just for those in California? This new idea is derivative of what Spirit does. One to watch for sure. I had a couple of news notes too, Scott. First, Delta CEO Ed Bastian said in an interview with Fast Company magazine that the airline's premium push relies on reliability. It took Delta more than a decade to really become a lot more reliable. Gil West was part of that, as you mentioned. Ed Bastian credits the Delta dependability more than lounges or premium seats or free Wi-Fi with driving premium revenue. He noted that in 2010, after the merger with Northwest Airlines, Delta canceled 6,000 flights during the year. In 2019, there were 60 cancellations. An airline has to be reliable before it can attract premium prices. And I found it interesting that United Airlines customers got a memo from CEO Scott Kirby saying the carrier was conducting a safety review after a string of problems from a wheel falling off an airplane to an airplane running off a taxiway. The problems all seem to be unrelated, but in this era of instant alerts of any commercial aircraft problem, Scott felt the need to get in front of news. He said the incidents, quote, have our attention and have sharpened our focus. I think it was a smart move.
It's what you have to do as CEO these days, right? And by the way, it's not what Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun did. The Boeing problems are so much worse, and the Boeing communications have been so much worse as well. One more thing to add on United, Ben. Late last week, the airline sent a memo out to employees saying the FAA was stepping up its oversight. Standard procedure when there's a rash of incidents. It's also interesting to note that these kinds of incidents happen all the time. What's different now is that they instantly become news, but certainly more attention to safety is a good thing. I thought Ed Bastian's comments were interesting as well. It always fascinated me that it is cheaper to run a reliable airline than it is to run an airline that's always late and always canceling flights. Running on time maximizes use of gate agents, flight attendants, pilots, customer service agents, gates, airplanes, just about everything. You burn less fuel, you misconnect fewer passengers and bags, you require fewer reserve crews, maintenance gets done on schedule, the benefits just go on and on. And couple that with the big Boeing losses. Building quality airplanes without cutting corners is, in the long run, much cheaper, right? That's what we're seeing now. All these McDonnell Douglas and General Electric penny pinchers who thought cutting costs was the way to boost profits at Boeing were wrong. The groundings of the 787 and the 737 MAX have been far more costly in lives, in reputation, in sales, and in earnings, and in cash. Same lesson for airlines and Boeing. Quality is cheaper in the long run. Another thing I'm sure of is that we have quality sponsors on Airlines Confidential. We want to thank DoHop, which is revolutionizing travel connectivity. DoHop is a travel technology provider enabling airlines to expand their networks, offer more connectivity, create additional partnerships, and focus on improving the customer experience with more offers, services, and travel options. Airlines benefit from generating additional revenue, lower costs, and maintaining full customer ownership. Plus, in the event of travel disruptions, DoHop works with airlines and offers assistance in helping passengers reach their final destination. Visit DoHop.com. That's DoHop.com.
And we want to thank Cirium, which offers the most accurate and precise data and analytics to enable airlines to optimize planning, operations, and passenger services. The right intelligence drives operational efficiencies, enables you to predict market shifts, and help airlines respond quickly to maximize revenue, manage costs, and seize commercial opportunity. Visit Cirium.com for more.
And we also want to thank Pratt & Whitney. At Pratt & Whitney, the pursuit of more sustainable aviation is foundational. For decades, Pratt & Whitney has been at the forefront of revolutionary advancements in aircraft propulsion technology. And by working smarter, cleaner, and greener today, they're committed to supporting the aviation industry in its goal of reaching net zero CO2 emissions by 2050. Learn more about Pratt & Whitney's smarter technology, cleaner fuel, and greener business at PrattWhitney.com. Let's bring in our guest, John Heimlich, and talk about the economics of the airline business.
We're happy to welcome John Heimlich back to the show. John is Vice President and Chief Economist at Airlines for America. He's been a friend of the show for years, and I'm convinced that he has the clearest crystal ball in the industry. We're excited to hear your current views, John.
So nice to be with you guys today.
John, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it. So before we get to the clarity of the crystal ball, let's look back at last year. What do you think we learned about the airline industry and passenger demand last year?
Well, great to be with you, Scott and Ben. I think looking back on last year, look, data from DOT just came out, a week ago, confirming it was indeed an all-time high of passenger volume in this industry. I would say demand, it proved to be resilient. You know, we also have a factoid. We just published the results of our annual survey we've conducted, I think, since 2016 through Ipsos, a survey of the American public. And not only did 86% say they had flown at least once in their lifetimes, but 49% of American adults said they took at least one flight in 2023. That, I believe, is an all-time high, although we don't have data for every year. But it was about one out of five Americans flew in the past year in the early 70s. So now we're saying half the population. So let me just add, demand is resilient. I think there's affirmation that there's an interest in premium products, at least with a significant share of customers. The feeling of YOLO is alive and well. People want to travel. And lastly, that I think flexible work, which has seems to have stabilized at around 30% of paid workdays, does make a difference in people's ability to make some trips work that otherwise wouldn't.
Tell us where you think the airline economy is right now.
I think the economy is looking good. You know, they joke that this is the most anticipated recession in U.S. history.
Yeah.
But you know, if you look at the Wall Street Journal's own survey of economists, it gets increasingly optimistic going back a couple of years. So now we're at a point where for Wells Fargo, Standard & Poor's, they've generally raised their U.S. Economic growth projection from 1.7% this year to about 2.4%. And many of them are saying, rather than a likely recession, they're saying, okay, it may not be a recession, but we'll see below trend growth in the back half of the year. So generally speaking, and with anticipation, of course, that the Fed will lower rates, which would be generally speaking stimulative. So and you combine that with, you know, anecdotal evidence of a slow but steady return of business travel, I think we're looking pretty good.
It's not necessarily even though, right? There's clearly weakness in overcapacity in some leisure routes. The low-cost carriers aren't earning money yet.
There's no question about that. You know, it's a diverse set of business models and a diverse clientele. And you know, to the extent that you are getting folks off the couch or out of a car to fly, those tend to be the folks that are most price sensitive and therefore the most exposed to broader inflation throughout the economy. I think now that real wages, you know, have started to grow, that's positive. But then they face the headwinds of, you know, resuming student loan payments and of course, the cost of housing rentals and such is a challenge. So they're facing a number of headwinds. But as you know from, you know, reading the aviation news, the carriers who are most dependent on that end of the spectrum have been working hard to realign their networks, you know, take markets that had perceived overcapacity and deploy them elsewhere. And of course, this year, even if you wanted to grow faster, and I'm sure we'll get to this, but supply chain issues in aerospace manufacturing, maintenance, engines, all that are forcing a lot of carriers to trim. So
right.
That itself will address some of the revenue issues.
Yeah. So that's exactly what I was thinking. We've postulated that aircraft delivery challenges and engine issues and air traffic control capacity problems and labor shortages, that all has contributed to a challenging reset for the industry. Are we off base?
No, that's absolutely right, Scott. And I think this is a multi-year issue. I would say at least 3 full years. And I think I was just reading that, you know, with some Asian carrier orders that just came in, wide body slots are booked pretty much through 2030. And you know, we already had some engine stuff with CFM and the geared turbofan, and now there are bottlenecks in maintenance, the aircraft delivery delays. You know, I think Southwest, just as an example, is down about 36 aircraft deliveries from where they had contractually expected to come in this year. And United, by my counts, down about 103 just for this year. Mm-hmm. And then you have Ed Bastian saying, you know, we think that Max 10 could be come in as late as 2027. So, you know, there is no question that this is, to me, the dominant theme last year. So it adds in with the air traffic control shortages, these aircraft delivery delays, engine challenges, maintenance, you know, MRO bottlenecks are the dominant theme. I recently gave a presentation. I thought hard about my message, and I came up with this title of "Demand is Sound, but Constraints Abound."
Yeah.
And I think that's what this year is all about.
Mm-hmm. It seems like ancillary revenue, especially selling miles and baggage fees, early boarding, and lounge access to credit card companies, is a big part of airline profits. How important is that part of the business?
You know, I think in terms of a share of revenue, it's not strikingly high. It can be a little difficult to quantify. But I think it's generally high margin business where the folks you're bringing in with that business are ones who tend to favor a premium product. They'll tend to pay more for a fare than other people would. They'll use your lounges. They can be sort of addicted to the points and addicted to flying one airline over another for the loyalty. You're bringing those folks into your system. And if you're offering, if you're saying, you know, we'll give you free Wi-Fi for mileage, or we'll, you'll get a discount on your Starbucks or your Lyft, that kind of cross-selling and bringing folks in your ecosystem is drawing valuable passengers to you away from a competitor. It's also, you know, when someone enters your frequent flyer program, they're basically volunteering to share data with you, right? About, you know, where they live, how often they fly, those sorts of valuable pieces of market intelligence that then airlines can use to tailor offers and better understand their own business. So I think there are a multitude of benefits from doing that, and it's generally seen as a high margin part of the business.
It's also a part of the business that could be threatened. Is congressional action a real risk to airline ancillary revenue? What could that do to the industry?
Yeah, you know, I would say congressional or regulatory. There are certain authorities that DOT already has, and for example, to require certain more extensive reporting. But yes, Congress could add to that more power to curb the right to charge certain amounts for certain services. And, you know, of course, that's something we oppose. I think, ironically, it would hurt the ultra low cost portion of the business more than others, which is the part that seems to be hurting right now. It would also hurt the lowest fare customers. It would probably put upward pressure on average fares, because you couldn't unbundle in such a way that people who don't want those extras or services are forced in a way to pay for them as part of the standard fare. So, you know, it takes away some tools for certain business models. Is it a real risk? It's in some way it's been a risk probably for 15 plus years now. But I think so far, you know, look, the reality is that, you know, inflation adjusted fares last year without ancillaries, actually sort of with bag fees and change fees, I should say, for the average customer, were the lowest in history with the exception of 2020 and 2021, which are, of course, battered by the pandemic. So I think we have a good story, and I think it's very clear that the fully unbundled products, whether it's at an ultra low cost carrier or a basic economy product for a global network carrier, have enabled a certain cadre of the population to fly who otherwise wouldn't be able to afford it. I think the flip side is that, and by the way, it helps airlines avoid costs, incurring costs for services that passengers don't value. You don't need as many baggage carts or personnel to sling bags, and you avoid lost time injuries with those workers. So that's part of the logic for it. And by the way, just to use an example of food, you know, if we think back, let's say to the 90s, for example, when, you know, on many even short haul flights, it was standard to get some kind of sandwich. Well, I think the three of us are old enough to remember it wasn't a sandwich that would knock your socks off. It was part of the fare. And, you know, when you're catering to the masses, you know, mass production of food doesn't sound appealing to anyone. And when you say, well, I'm only going to, you know, offer this meal to the person who's willing to pay for it on this flight, you tend to get a much better meal. So there is a logic to that as well.
Scott Kirby and others have said that the LCC business model is done, that higher costs will end their advantage. Are LCC businesses' models really outdated?
Well, there will always be, I think, a lower cost sector. You know, I think to the extent that everyone's costs are in some respects high these days, or at least higher, you know, probably lower cost is more appropriate than low or ultra low in absolute terms. But there is definitely room for carriers who have, you know, lower unit costs than global network carriers to exist. But I do think that they're all rightly working hard to restructure, realign, rethink how and where they market their product. And it's a very challenging time. I think they were some of the largest victims of the pilot scarcity, which forced upward pressure on their labor costs. Now they're some of the victims of some of these aircraft and engine quality issues, which have curtailed their traditional rates of growth, which means it's hard to keep costs down. And if you do that, then it's hard to have a low fare advantage when you no longer had the same cost advantage you once did, especially if global network carriers are offering a fare that matches them in basic economy. So that's the challenge. I think the sector is by no means dead, but I think they are rightly and publicly working hard to address the current environment.
Diplomatically said, John. So how much is the shortage of air traffic controllers costing airlines? We know it's forced some schedule cuts and led to delays, but any idea of the kind of money we're talking about, what it might do to the industry if it's not fixed soon?
You know, it's a great question. We haven't quantified it. You're right that in terms of schedule cuts, well, sure, that puts pressure on your unit costs. It also means foregone revenue. I think there are definitely some markets or some frequencies the airlines would like to deploy to generate revenue they're foregoing right now.
And probably higher fares because there's less capacity.
In some markets, that's probably true. This is essentially, government-forced capacity reduction or capacity constraint, which is ironic. That's essentially what slot control and capacity caps are. Now, maybe the impact's a little less at a time where you're not able to receive as many aircraft as you want. On the other hand, many airlines are making up for that by holding on to older aircraft longer than they would like to otherwise. But no doubt net, there's less capacity than they'd like to fly. I think the other thing is, in a lot of cases, even where they are maintaining the same level of flying, the controller shortage can manifest itself in longer miles and trail for a given flight, more encircling or sitting on the ground at one end of the flight, awaiting a departure clearance so you can get through the en route system to get to your destination. So that can be delays and fuel burn and misconnects and things. So it matters. And, you know, while the FAA got behind before the pandemic made it worse. We're thrilled that they've, resurrected the college training initiative. That'll be a big boost. That, like the aircraft delivery issue, is, I think, at least a few years of a problem.
What's the single biggest threat to airline profitability right now? Escalating labor costs, oil, pilot shortage, passenger demand?
You know, I think it's what's different right now is maintenance costs and aircraft costs. So there's no question, you know, oil is high, but it's steady and it's tolerable. And I think it's at a level that airlines have learned to cope with. There's no question that labor costs have come up. It's probably a bigger issue for lower cost carriers because of the revenue situation we discussed and because of their historical dependency on growth, which isn't available in a aircraft and engine constrained environment. But what is a little bit different in these times, and it's not being talked about as much, is there are not enough, and this includes in the supply chain of MROs. I think aviation maintenance technicians, the ones that are out there in order to offset some of the attrition, you had to raise wages quite a bit to draw them in. So in some cases, you have longer wait times to get your aircraft or engine in for repair. Once you do, there's a longer turnaround time. Even when it's done, it's more expensive to reform because the labor is higher, the materials are higher because of a parts scarcity. And there's not as many parts because when you're not taking new aircraft, you're holding on to old aircraft, which are therefore not being parted out. So carriers are holding on to more inventory to deal with maintenance. I was recently at the ISTAT conference in Austin, and there were numbers where something like 20% higher cost to buy a new aircraft, I think 30% higher for lease rates, and about 40% higher for maintenance costs. So to me, while those aren't as large a share as labor and fuel, those are the ones that are more unique to this year and probably next year than we've seen in the past.
That's fascinating. Really interesting.
Yeah, I think the challenges are much more right now on the, the constraints and the cost side than they are on the revenue side of the ledger.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Speaking of what's fascinating, we're at opening day this week in baseball season. Do your beloved Cleveland Guardians have any chance this year?
Our favorite saying in Cleveland is, besides there's always next year, it's a rebuilding year.
Uh-huh.
and I think that's where the Guardians are right now. I'd love to say there's always a chance. I'm fortunate that in my lifetime, I've seen three World Series. I'm still waiting for the victory. Sure, they have a shot this year, but I think we're quite the dark horse, to be honest.
Mm. Well, good luck. Good luck with it all this year.
Thank you.
John, thanks so much for joining us. It's been enlightening and I think very timely. Glad we could catch up.
Yeah, always a pleasure to talk to you guys. Thanks for the show.
And we'll be back with more on Airlines Confidential in a minute.
Promotional consideration provided by thearchive.net, celebrating 20 years with a fresh new look and over 60,000 items of AvGeek goodness. It's the hub of air transport history, and you're welcome aboard thearchive.net.
Thanks again to John for our quarterly economic update on the industry. As I said, I think he really has good analysis and a clear crystal ball of where things are going. I want to remind listeners that Airlines Confidential will be on stage for a keynote podcast at Aviation Festival Americas on May 15th in Miami Beach. This is the 16th year for Aviation Festival Americas, and it brings together more than 250 influential leaders from the U.S., Canada, and Latin America. If you'd like to attend, listeners can get a 50% discount by going to airlinesconfidential.com, clicking on the Aviation Festival banner ad, and using the promo code AC50. It's going to be a great event, and we are looking forward to being part of it.
Ben, in the mailbag this week were a couple of notes from listeners questioning the security risks that Doug Parker identified with the lack of TSA screening at scheduled charter carriers. One listener noted that charters don't get full TSA screening either, and another listener noted that private jets don't get TSA screening. I just wanted to say I don't think those examples are equivalent at all. You can't buy a ticket online for $129 for a charter or a private jet. Charters and private jets aren't open to the general public in the same way as scheduled charter service. In almost all aspects, scheduled charter carriers are operating, or at least to the public eye, as airlines, and if there were to be an attack, it would be seen as an attack on airline service. If there's an issue with the charter or private jet, the traveling public would not think there's a risk to them. Yes, a terrorist group could charter a plane or hire a private jet, but they would be the only ones on board besides the crew. The risk is very, very different. Terrorism is about generating fear and disrupting our normal lives and our economy. You're not going to do that by blowing yourself up on a private jet.
I actually think that anyone boarding any size airplane should have some screening. Imagine the damage even a private business jet could do in the wrong person's hands.
Eric from Vancouver, Washington, responded to our interview with Rudy Maxa last week by saying, "I was shocked that Rudy Maxa was on the fence about traveling to Russia and Somalia, suggesting he wasn't important enough to be kidnapped and that the main downside was needing some local guide since he wouldn't know the area and where was safe. He seemed naive about the seriousness of the threat to American travelers in those countries. You could get lucky and nothing happens to you, but I think it would be wise to cross those countries off his list for a long time. We're in a near war with Russia. Any American would be an asset for Putin, not to mention whether traveling there as a tourist would violate U.S. sanctions." I have to say, Ben, that as a former colleague of Evan Gershkovich at the Wall Street Journal, and someone shocked by the atrocities Russia has carried out in Ukraine and the brutal murder of political opposition leaders, that I agree with that. No one should be traveling to Russia, and I think Rudy was basically saying he wouldn't go now.
I was surprised at Rudy Maxa's picks, but he is a much savvier traveler than me, so he might be right. That said, I would not choose Russia or Somalia either. Scott, I wanted to thank everyone again for all the good wishes and acceptance of my new voice option. And here's one other question this week from Joe in California. "Hi, guys. Love the show. Do you think there will ever come a day when airplanes will no longer need maintenance tech ops agents doing maintenance work on aircraft?" I don't think so, Joe. Big machines with moving parts will always need maintenance. Even bicycles need maintenance. That said, airplanes could get smarter about how they treat maintenance. Today, some airplane parts predict their own failure, and mechanics can replace a part before it actually breaks. By better prediction and management, airplanes might become less expensive to maintain, but will still need maintenance for sure. If you are really just asking if maintenance tech ops pros will be needed, I think the answer to that is yes also.
Yeah, I agree. Maybe the question really is whether airplanes will be able to fix themselves. Diagnosing the problem is one thing, executing the repair, maybe someday with robots or whatever. But certainly an electric car needs a lot less maintenance than a gasoline-powered car. So maybe someday there will be fewer maintenance requirements for airplanes. But I agree, we're always going to need maintenance techs. That's all for another edition of Airlines Confidential. We'll be back with more next week, unless we all get replaced by robots.
Thanks for listening, and have a great week, everyone.
This podcast is produced by Mass Media. Info at massmedia.net.